Purdy.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Wade Keller, and it is my distinct honor to be your president this year. And speaking of this year, what a year. How about for your first speaker of the year, Newt Gingrich?
Newt.
I want to start by recognizing some people. And the first group I want to recognize are our brand new members this year. You've got a green dot on your name tag. And would all the green dot people please stand up? Would you stand up and let's just recognize you? You know, today, as you see these people with the green dot on, please shake their hand and let them know that they are really welcome in the club, and we're glad to have them with the club. Each year, the board, one-third of the board rotates off. It joins the ranks of the past directors. Another one-third comes on for a three-year term. I want to recognize the people who rotated off. Some of them are here. Connor Small-Bodman, if you're here, please stand. Catherine Eckhoff-Smith, Joe Fogg, C.J. Houston. C.J., would you stand? Ralph Lawson, Dick Splitoff, and Roy White. Would you stand and hold your applause for just a second? Roy, where are you? I know you're here. Okay. And Dick, where are you? All right. Would all the other past directors with the nice silver badges, would you please stand and let us appreciate your past service to the club? And then we've got a new board this year, and I'm really excited. We've got an outstanding board, as usual, and I would like to recognize the new board members that are coming on board this year, or on board already. Bill Allen, would you stand? Vincent Oprazizi, he was helping me with the pronunciation this morning. Vincent, where are you? Where's Vincent? Oh, okay. Oh, there you are. Pagliotti. Pat Franciosi, Kim Cantor, Ken Creer, Bob Nichols, and Jack Stafford. Would you all stand, and would the rest of the board of directors please stand, and let us thank you for your service. And then there's one other group that knows exactly how I feel right now, and that's the past presidents. Past presidents with the gold badges, would you stand and let us appreciate you? Thank you. Malcolm, Alan, Dick, great. You know, all of us in the leadership here at the club, we serve for the honor and the glory of being part of this Forum Club, and it's really a great club, but there's one person who really makes everything happen, and if we ever look good, the leadership, it's because of this one person and her staff, and that's our executive director. She's still working, Ellie Creer, and her staff. Now, I've got a couple of other items of business before we get to the invocation. And our board member who's chairman of the Education Committee this year is Dick Monroe. Dick, before I get to you, I've got one other order of business I almost forgot. But you're on notice. You know, next November the 11th is Veterans Day. And I want to just take just a second to recognize all the veterans. You know, we're the land of the free because and only as long as we're the home of the brave. and we owe a great debt to these veterans. I'm going to ask you to stand. I wonder if we have any Coast Guard veterans. We'll go by service. Do we have any Coast Guard veterans? Please stand. Yeah, Bill? Yeah. Great. All right. How about Marines? If Dick were sitting, he'd be standing. So, and Air Force, my daughter Michelle and Sean. Okay. Navy. All right. And finally, the Army. All right. And now, let's bring up that Marine, Dick Monroe, for the Education Committee.
Good afternoon, everyone. Our gracious chairman has given me 30 seconds. I think I can do it in 22. You will notice on your tables a yellow, it's hard to miss this, it is described as the student sponsorship form. Everybody see it? It's hard to miss. It simply presents all of you with the opportunity to make a charitable contribution to, in the benefit of Collier County High School students, the ones that you are about to hear and by whom you will be very impressed. All we ask you to do is to consider this opportunity, and I thank you very much. And November 12th is the Marine Corps birthday.
Thank you, Dick. And now a big part of our meeting is the students, and we get to hear from the students now. I ask Shelley Church to come introduce the students.
Thank you. Guys, you want to come on up and get ready to come on up? I'm delighted to introduce Laely High School today. Laely is the only school that we have, and we have six incredibly bright young men and women who are attending. They're bright academically, and also some of them are involved in sports. One just won a diving championship, I believe, which is great. Laely High School is out in East Naples, and it's a very diverse school. The model of the school I thought was very interesting. If we had music, we'd play it for you. But every Friday at school, they play the song We Are Family, which I think is great. Last year, they had 120 students qualify for Bright Futures Scholarships, which is a program offered through the state of Florida. And academically, you have to be at a certain level in order to get the Bright Futures. Also, anywhere between 8 and 10 students each year from Laely qualify for the Collier County school program, laureate program. Laely has a very strong ROTC program, a criminal justice academy, and a teacher assisting academy, as well as a construction academy. So a lot of students are trained to actually go into a field of business as soon as they get out of high school. They have a very successful football program with over 120 players on three teams. They have a big game tonight against Barron Collier, I guess, for a championship title, so let's certainly hope that they do well. And interesting, they have a ninth grade academy that they recently started, which is to help transition middle school students and find the at-risk students early, which will help with the graduation rate at the high school. So I know you don't want to hear from me, and I'm sorry I did forget to introduce the counselor with Laely today. Peg Rialli? Peg, I'm sorry. I should have done that first. I have to get in my groove. We're starting a new year, and I also didn't introduce the sponsors this year for the students, which are very important to us, and that's Dick and Joe Rogan are paying for the students to attend today, and I want thank you guys very much for doing that. We really appreciate it. So without any further ado, I'm going to let the students each tell you a little bit about themselves.
Hello, I'm Sander Langebeke. I'm 17 years old. I'm a senior at Laely. I'm from Holland. I was born there and moved here in 2001. I swim for Laely. I used to play basketball in sophomore year, and I run track all 3 years and planning to this year. I was captain for the swim team this year, and I coach a JV basketball team, the Mark Weiland Charter Middle School JV team. I want to become a teacher and help as many people in the world, and I think teaching really does that. So that's what I want to do, and I'm going to do a double major, one in teaching and one in accounting. So have a nice day.
Hi, I'm Cody Crawford, 17 also, senior at Laley High School. School I'm involved with the National Honor Society, Student Council, and the Chemistry Club as well. For college, I'm hoping to go to either UF or MIT to do a chemical engineering major, trying to work with the raw materials and find valuable ways to use them, everything like that. That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Doug Knox, a senior at Laley High School. As she said, I just recently competed in the regional diving championships, and I'm proud to say that I took first place. So, thank you. Next week I have states. Diving's pretty important, but school has always been my first priority, and I'm proud to say that I'm number one in my class. And as for my plans after high school, my top choices are the UCF Honors College or Columbia University, and I'm considering diving for Columbia. So we'll see. Pray that I get in. Cross my fingers. And I'd just like to thank you for having me today. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Abbott. Sorry. I'm a senior at Laley High School, and I'm number two in the senior class. I was actually born in Jamaica and moved here when I was 3 years old and have lived here ever since. I'm the captain of the Laley High School Guard and president of National Honor Society, as well as a member of many other clubs. Currently, I have applied to University of Florida and University of Miami. I also plan to apply to Duke University and want to study biomedical engineering, hopefully to become a pediatrician. Thank you for having us here today.
Hi, I'm Christina Martinez. I'm 17 and I'm a senior at Laley High School. I'm involved in a lot of clubs at school, like I'm treasurer of National Honor Society and a member of the Spanish National Honor Society. I'm also a captain of varsity cheerleading, and in the future, well, I've applied to the University of Florida, University of Miami, and University of Central Florida. I hope to go to the University of Florida and possibly study journalism and communications. So, and that's it. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Diana Paul. I am a part of the student council. I play varsity basketball and I run track. I'm part of Fellowship of Christian Athletes and also Rotary Interact. I've applied to 6 schools, including University of Florida, University of Miami, University of Tampa, UCF, USF, and Florida State. Right now, Florida State's my number one choice so that I can major in sports management and exercise science so that I can pursue a career as a exercise sociologist. And I was born in Haiti. I have 5 brothers and sisters. I have 5 brothers and 4 sisters. And I enjoy spending a lot of time with my family. Thank you for having us here today.
Thank you, Shelley. Great job. Great job, students. We appreciate having you now. Now for the invocation, let's welcome Rabbi Edward Moline from the Jewish Congregation of Marco Island. Rabbi Moline.
I'm very pleased to be here today to welcome you and to welcome our special guest of honor for this first meeting of the Forum Club for this season. At this historic hour through which we are passing, our nation and our world are in great turmoil. The litany of woes that confront us include the economic downturn, the recession, the loss of property values, high unemployment, home foreclosures, and abroad the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the continuing conflict in the Middle East between Arabs and Israelis, the tensions between radical Islam and Western civilization. Seemingly, there is no end to the folly and the absurdity of war, of terror and violence, to solve human problems. In my tradition, God has many names, but one of the names in Hebrew, Hamadaber, refers to God as the speaker. I thought you might appreciate that, Mr. Gingrich. Our rabbis interpreted that to mean that it is through speech, through the words we speak, that we let God in or shut him out of the world. Mr. Speaker, regardless of our political allegiances, your words are extremely eloquent. They reflect unique insights and a deep knowledge of the problems that beset us. We hope you will address some of the concerns and perhaps offer suggestions as to how we can resolve them, so that our nation and our world can experience greater tranquility, serenity, and peace for our generation and generations yet to come. We welcome you to Naples, and as some say, we welcome you to paradise. We offer the blessing over the food of which we're about to partake with the ancient words of blessing. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who brings forth food from the earth. And may the time not be distant when no man, woman, or child will hunger for his or her daily bread, and all will enjoy the abundance of life and of the earth. Amen.
Thank you, Rabbi, and I will be back at 12:40 to continue the program. See you then. Well, just to show you how nervous I am on the first day, I took a big bite and just ran up here. So I had to stand here for a minute to get ready. The most important job in the Forum Club is held by the president-elect as chairman of the program committee. This person is responsible for getting the programs for next year, and I will introduce that person now to introduce our speaker. Please welcome our president-elect, Ulla Norris. Ulla.
Thank you, Wade. First of all, I want to thank Forum Club member Joe Fogg for bringing Speaker Gingrich to us. With this week's elections, the timing couldn't be better. Joe is very sorry that he couldn't be here and has asked me to stand in for him. When asked to introduce Newt Gingrich, the question is, how do you edit his massive and hugely important bio in order for it to fit in with our limited time? But fortunately, Newt is one of those instantly recognizable one-word names which really needs very little introduction. Since the speaker came to Congress as a representative from Georgia in 1978 until today, he has had a profound influence on American political thinking. In 1994, Newt became a household word as Americans came to know him as the architect of the Contract with America, which spelled out basic conservative principles: lower taxes, welfare reform and greater personal responsibility, tort reform, greater entrepreneurial activity, and just think, a balanced budget. The Contract with America is credited with securing a Republican majority in both houses of Congress in 1994, the first time in 40 years. Mr. Gingrich subsequently became Speaker of the House in 1995, a position he held until 1999. In addition to being a politician, we also know the Speaker as a brilliant educator and communicator, whose well-reasoned opinions are based not on political expediency, but on logic and a solid grasp of history. He taught history as well as environmental studies before coming to Congress. He still continues to teach at the National Defense University, driven by an intense interest in national security issues. His ideas in the latter area led President Bush to establish the Department of Homeland Security, headed by a cabinet-level secretary. The speaker is a leading proponent of increased federal funding for basic scientific research. He is also a strong advocate of volunteerism, who believes that the individual can make a difference. He supports, among other causes, Habitat for Humanity, United Cerebral Palsy, the American Cancer Society, and Zoo Atlanta. In his spare time, Newt Gingrich has written no less than 20 books, including the most recent one, To Try Men's Souls, which came out just the other day. And together with his wife, Calista, he hosts and produces documentaries. If you have not heard about his latest initiative, American Solutions for Winning the Future, I'm sure you will. Mr. Speaker, where is the speaker? Mr. Speaker, you are not only a politician, you are, sir, a statesman. And I yield the floor.
Thank you. That's very generous. Well, thank you all very, very much. I'm delighted to be here. We actually had our Center for Health Transformation meeting at the Ritz on the beach, which we do now every year in November, and it's become our most popular meeting with our members. The number of members of our center who renew annually as they're standing along the beach in the sunny weather, concluding that the center is in fact a very wise and useful organization, has made us very fond of coming to Naples. I hope all of you will tell Joe Fogg that I did notice he was not here since he told me I had to come here. I just wanted to remind you. This is your 25th anniversary, and it occurred to me as I was having lunch, if you go back 25 years to 1984, and you ask yourself, if I had been coming here to speak to you in November of 1984, how likely would you have been to believe a talk which began shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the disappearance of the Soviet Empire? Think about that. It's 5 years away from the fall of the Berlin Wall, which the 20th anniversary is next Tuesday, or next Monday, and it is 7 years away from the collapse of the Soviet Empire, which actually propitiously disappeared on Christmas Day, 1991, which is kind of a gift to the planet. And think about how much the world's changed. The decisive moment which would change Chinese history would still be 8 years away, the southern tour of Deng Xiaoping, in which he said, "I do not care if a cat is white or a cat is black, I care if it catches mice," which was a fundamental assault on communist ideology and an argument that the number one challenge to the Chinese government was to create jobs, that markets created jobs, and that therefore China had to become a market economy, which has enormous effect. All those things were in the future. So to go back to 1984, I think a lot about that period because Cliss and I just did a movie called Ronald Reagan, Rendezvous with Destiny. It's a terrific film. First off, you make a film with Ronald Reagan, it is a terrific film because he's so good on television and so good, you know, that you're automatically going to look good. But second, it's a very educational film. We have about 6 minutes of Jimmy Carter. And it is useful in terms of understanding where we are now with this morning's announcement of 10.2% unemployment, with Speaker Pelosi's suicidal decision to try to ram through a health bill that is increasingly unpopular, and with a series of proposals to raise taxes in an economy that's already weak. In that environment, it's helpful to go back and remember Jimmy Carter. Some of you will remember the ultimate results were 22% interest rates, 13% inflation, rising unemployment, gasoline rationing because the government so mismanaged the gasoline market. It was a lot like the flu vaccine this fall. Government's inability to manage markets effectively is just breathtaking and repeated by powerful but unwise people on a regular basis. And some of you may remember gas rationing where you could only buy gasoline every other day based on the last digit of your license plate. A good friend of mine who helped make movies with us, Dave Bossio of Citizens United, said to me one day, he was 13 that year, and every morning his father would give him a screwdriver to go out and change the license plates on the car so that the car which needed gasoline had the correct license plate. And I derive from that what I'm going to call Bossi's Law, which is you can tell if you're a liberal or a conservative by the following proposition. If the government adopts a regulation so stupid that we're teaching 13-year-olds to change license plates, and you believe that means we should drop the regulation, you're a conservative. If, on the other hand, you conclude that means we need license plate police at every gas station, then you're a truly committed liberal. And so it gives you a good model against which. In that setting, by the way, when you see the movie, it's interesting because you suddenly realize how totally out of it Carter was. And we have just about 90 seconds of Carter's famous malaise speech, in which, by the way, he never actually used the word malaise. Malaise came from a Harvard sociology professor's book, which he had read by a guy named Lash. But Carter's voice and the look on his face is he says, you know, this crisis of confidence it's invisible. You can't see it. And you see this thing for a second, and you realize that what happened, and this is, I'm building up to a practical current situation, but I think starting in 1984 is a great way to do it. What people, the American people looked up and they said, let me get this straight. The whole thing's totally messed up. The economy's a disaster. We have a 444-day hostage crisis in Iran. The Russians have invaded Afghanistan. They're in Grenada, Mozambique, Angola, Nicaragua. They're trying to get into El Salvador. And we have a president who's talking about malaise and lack of confidence and being confused. And they said, now, one of two things is true. Either we are entering the age of malaise or we need to fire him. And they thought about it for about 12 seconds and thought, got it. He's gone. New person. Reagan campaigned that year. We forget, by the way, because we see Reagan in retrospect when he was president. Reagan was a very tough candidate. And Reagan campaigned that year, and one of his favorite lines was, if your brother-in-law loses his job, it's called a recession. If you lose your job, it's called a depression. If Jimmy Carter loses his job, it's called a recovery. Yeah. Now, I give you this as background because the message of To Try Men's Souls is, get a grip. This country was reduced on Christmas Day, 1776, to 2,500 people, less than one out of every 1,000 Americans. And one-third of the 2,500 didn't have boots. They wrapped their feet in burlap, and they marched 9 miles in the snowstorm on an icy road that was unpaved, and they left a trail of blood. So as you start to complain, be depressed, wonder what's going on in Washington, think about your political leaders, we've been here before. There is nothing going on in Washington or Tallahassee or anywhere else in American government that a handful of sweeping elections wouldn't change almost overnight. And it's important to remember, going back to 1984, that in 1979, 1980, the elites of both parties understood the Soviet Union was permanent. Samuelson, in fact, wrote a textbook in which he said the Soviet economy may be superior to the Western economy. We had to have détente, a French word meaning understanding. We had to deal with them with respect. Reagan comes along, a reporter says to him, "What's your vision of the Cold War?" He says, "We win, they lose." That's an extraordinary sentence. First of all, and no true liberal could have said it. First of all, there was the word "we." I mean, what an exclusionist, narrow, xenophobic term. It implies that there is a they. Second, he had the word "win." Such a harsh word, implying that there's somebody who loses. Now, the average American who's a sports fan looked up and said, "We win, they lose." Yeah, I feel that way every Friday and Saturday. Or Sunday, if you like pro sports. And they got it instantly. The amazing thing about Reagan is he actually meant it. Which is why he gave the Evil Empire speech, the Strategic Defense Initiative, launched an offensive. Now, in looking at that period, we interviewed, for the Reagan film, we interviewed Lech Walesa in Gdansk, and we interviewed Vaclav Havel in Prague. Both of them said one of the decisive moments was Pope John Paul II's 9-day visit to Poland in September of 1979, that the emotional power, the spiritual power, the intellectual argument that in order to be free, you had to have religious liberty, you had to be able to approach God, because without God, you couldn't be a complete human being. That set off a reaction across all of Eastern Europe, and in particular in Poland, that never died down after that. This was, remember, before Reagan's even elected. So we now are in the process of finishing a movie called 9 Days That Changed the World. And in the process, and we've gotten terrific footage from the Polish bishops that's never been seen before, and it's a very, very powerful movie. And in the process of doing that, we ran across the following fact, which I think could become the most important slogan in American politics in the next 20 years. The Poles, in their fight with the dictatorship, developed a sign that said 2 plus 2 equals 4. I know it's bold. A lot of you probably had already figured it out. But here's what they were doing. Orwell, in 1984, has the state torturer say to the innocent citizen, if the state tells you 2 plus 2 equals 15, it equals 15. And if the state tells you 2 plus 2 equals 3, it equals 3. And the citizen's thinking, but what if it equals 4? Camus wrote in The Plague, there are times when a man will be killed for saying 2 plus 2 equals 4 because authority can't stand the truth. Now let me give you an American analog. I'm going to give you half of an equation and see how many of you can come up with the other half. If you can't afford to buy a house, anyone want to offer the second half? Seriously, what's the second half? How many of you would agree with the formula, if you can't afford to buy a house, don't buy it? Raise your hand. How many of you agree with this? Okay, now let me make my point here, which is I think very profound and fundamental for the future of this country. For 25 years, we've been lying. For 25 years, we've adopted government programs which said to people, if you can't afford to buy a house, we'll find a way to get you in a house you can't afford. We'll let you in a house without worrying about your credit. We're going to let you in a house without making you have a down payment. We'll let you in a house where for 3 years you don't have to pay any principal. We'll let you in a house with a below market interest rate. And when you do that to people, guess what? They go bankrupt because they can't afford it. That was the precondition of the formula. And then what happens? If one person goes bankrupt, it's a personal tragedy. When a million people go bankrupt, it's a national crisis. And have you heard a single politician in either party explain that what we're in the middle of is a cultural crisis with a political component leading to a financial disaster? They can't say it. First of all, they can't think it. And second, if they could think it, they wouldn't be allowed to say it. So I'm now, for just a couple minutes, going to give you a sweeping overview. This will be very short because I want to go to questions. But I'm going to give you a very sweeping overview of where I think we are and what I think we have to do. If you want to follow this and you want to see what we're doing, we're doing it at AmericanSolutions.com. And we have, and I do a weekly newsletter. I also Twitter for those of you who are into that sort of thing. We have like 1,150,000 followers on Twitter. I'm going to make three propositions that I believe are the three key questions for America's future that I believe should be the centerpiece of 2010 and 2012. And I'll tell you in advance, on the Republican side, I have two simple principles which I learned first in helping develop the Reagan majority in 1980, which I was involved in, and I learned second helping first create the contract with America, which led to the first Republican majority in 40 years, and second leading the Republicans so that for the first time since 1928, we got reelected, had not been reelected since 1928, and we got reelected while balancing the federal budget, cutting taxes, paying off $405 billion in debt, reforming welfare, strengthening intelligence and defense, and doubling the budget of the NIH. So there's a background to what I'm going to tell you. For the Republican side, I have two simple messages, and you can ask any Republican you run into, if they don't get these two, figure out a way to dump them. One. Republicans need to be the alternative party, not the opposition party. The country doesn't need opposition. The country needs better solutions because we're in real trouble. Two, the Republican Party has to be a center-right majority because it is impossible to govern this country from the hard right. And people on the hard right, if they're not careful, are going to make Nancy Pelosi Speaker for life and guarantee Obama's re-election. So those are just two passing messages for Republicans. If you run across any, feel free to share it with them. And let me be quite clear. I mean, I've been at this business since August of 1958. And if somebody says to you, we don't need to have alternatives, we can just be the opposition, you can just tell them from me, they're flat wrong. They're the kind of thinking that kept us in the minority, and they don't deserve to be a governing party if they can't figure out how to govern. It's very important that we set the right standard. Now, there are three questions that every politician in both parties should have to answer in 2010 and 2012. The first is, who are we? The second is, how do we successfully compete with China and India? And the third is, who threatens us and how do we defend America and our allies? Let me start with, who are we? I think this is the most important question because we're in the middle of a fundamental fight over the nature of being American. I have written a book called Rediscovering God in America, which is just coming out in a photo edition that my wife provided pictures for. We've done a movie by the same name and then a follow-up movie called Rediscovering God 2, which is from the colonial period to the end of the Civil War. The original book and the original movie, Rediscovering God in America, just simply walks around Washington and was my answer to the Ninth Circuit Court's utterly irrational and un-American decision that saying one nation under God and the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional, which in my judgment is grounds for abolishing the Ninth Circuit and creating a new court. Which, for those of you who think what I'm saying is too bold, is what the Jeffersonians did in the Judicial Reform Act of 1802 when they abolished 18 out of 35 federal judges. So the legislative branch and the president can defend the United States from arrogant dictatorial judges if they have the courage to do so. And anybody who wants to drive God out of public life in America is destroying the United States. Now, you may think that's strong language. And the young people who are here who grew up in an absurdly cleansed, edited, and censored school system may wonder, what am I even talking about? Well, here's the original political document, which every student should study. Declaration of Independence. We are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is a political document signed by the people who created this country. Now, it has two powerful meanings in that one sentence. The first is, we are the only country in history that said power comes from God to each one of you personally. You are personally sovereign. You loan power to the government. No president, no court, no bureaucrat, no lawyer can take that power away from you. That's what it means. That's why it's inalienable. Now, if God doesn't exist, and we're not allowed to discuss God, and we are now going to become a secular European nation, then we're merely randomly gathered protoplasm, fortunate not to be rhinoceroses. And we have no inherent rights. And we suffer what the state tolerates. And that's the beginning of the totalitarian model. So the boundary here is simple. Do you believe in America as defined in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence, or do you believe in a European secular socialist model of big government and tiny people? Because this model is strong people and a limited government, not a weak government, a limited government. Fundamental, everything, almost every public policy falls out of that decision. There's a second half to it. Notice what we're entitled to. The right to pursue happiness. There are two parts to this. First of all, in the Scottish Enlightenment, and I've seen the book Jefferson actually used, it's in the Library of Congress. He underlines, in the Scottish Enlightenment, the pursuit of happiness meant the pursuit of wisdom and virtue. It did not mean hedonism and acquisition. The pursuit of wisdom and virtue, but it's the pursuit. Notice, no entitlement to happiness. You can't sue if you're unhappy. No provision for a federal department of happiness. No provision for happiness stamps for the unhappy. No right to redistribute happiness. And so you end up with, God has given you these rights, which, by the way, you have to have a work ethic and you have to be responsible, so that being a citizen has responsibilities fully as much as rights, and therefore you need to pursue happiness to be an American. Versus, you're weak, pathetic, helpless, and if the politicians don't take care of you, how can you possibly have a good life? These are antithetical models. It's not the same world. That's the first question. Second question, simple. China and India are real. They're not a problem. They're a fact. There are 1,300,000,000 Chinese and 1 billion Indians, and they're going to come to play, and they're endowed by their Creator with the right to pursue happiness, and they're all going to roll up their sleeves and come play. And you as a forum ought to sometime have Bob Compton come here and get him to show you his movie 2 Million Minutes, which is 4 years of high school. He takes 2 Indian, 2 Chinese, and 2 American high school students, and at the end of 4 Million Minutes, 2 Million Minutes, you realize we are a country aggressively preparing for the 1956 Olympics. That we have to fundamentally rethink learning in America. I was recently in China, Japan, and Korea for 16 days and went to Beijing and 3 Manchurian cities. And in the process, I had an opportunity to talk to the Chinese officials about, they don't have a stimulus package. They have an investment package. They intend to build 225-mile-an-hour trains to connect all the Chinese cities. And they'll have the best, most sophisticated high-speed rail system in the world. And they're doing it in part because of the 1,300,000,000 people. They'll never buy enough airplanes. We have a stimulus package, which is politicians in Washington borrowing your children's money to loan to politicians in Tallahassee to avoid making decisions. So we're wasting the money. So if we're going to compete, I'm very simple about this. I have 2 grandchildren. Maggie is 10, Robert is 8. And I want them, when they're in their 40s and 50s, to be in the most productive, most creative, and most prosperous country in the world, which is necessary if they're going to be in the most secure country, because you cannot sustain national security without a high-tech, science-based, very productive economy. So I think this is truly a definition of America's future. In order for us to successfully compete with China and India, we have to reform litigation, regulation, taxation, education, health, energy, and infrastructure. It's that flat. Two quick examples. I've written two novels about World War II, Pearl Harbor and Days of Infamy. From December 7th, 1941 to August 1945, victory over Japan, is 3 years and 8 months. In 44 months, we mobilized 15.5 million people in uniform, build a two-ocean navy, build the B-17, B-24, B-29, build four cities and 29 facilities for the atomic bomb, sweep across North Africa, Sicily, Italy, France, Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, and occupy Germany, sweep across the Pacific in 44 months. It recently took 23 years to add a fifth runway to the Atlanta airport. 8 years after 9/11, we have not rebuilt the World Trade Center. In World War II, we'd have rebuilt it in 18 months. We'd have used exactly the same blueprints to rebuild exactly the same buildings in record time. We would have worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to say to the planet, you cannot stop us. Today, all you've got to do is get three lawyers and call two committee meetings, and you've stopped us flat. It is pathetic how incompetent our governments are at every level. Second example, our tax code is anti-investment, anti-jobs, anti-entrepreneur, and anti-savings. And it's achieving it. It's achieving exactly the results you'd think. We're not competitive. We have 10% unemployment. We owe the Chinese $2 trillion, and we're going to sink deeper into debt because we're dominated by politicians determined, passionate, to be steadily and methodically stupid. These are the opposite of Deng Xiaoping's great ruling in China. In 1992, as I said earlier, when Deng Xiaoping went on the Southern Tour, he said, I don't care if a cat is black or a cat is white as long as it catches mice. In Washington and in all too many of our state capitals, we're now dominated by politicians who, as long as it creates bigger jobs for more public employee unions, don't care what it kills. And the result is we are grinding down America's future. These kids are going to have a much harder time getting a job than they should. And when they get a job, they're going to have a much harder time having take-home pay. And when they get take-home pay, they're going to have a much harder time having a dollar that's worth anything. And it's because the policies are bad. It's not inevitable. It's not historical. It's not, you know, something that we just, those things happen. Baloney. So what would a good tax policy be like? I'm going to give you a very bold stimulus package that would lead to a fundamentally different country. One. For the next 2 years, have a 50% reduction in the Social Security and Medicare tax for both the employee and the employer match. You would overnight give everybody more money to pay off their debts. Every small business in the country would have greater liquidity. You'd begin to hire people again, and you'd start to create a different future. Two, match the Chinese. You want to create jobs matching China? Match the Chinese capital gains rate. It's zero. At zero capital gains, this country would explode with investment. Three, match the Irish corporate tax rate. We currently have the highest combined state and federal corporate tax rate in the world. Replace it with the Irish rate, which is 12.5%. You would overnight see an explosion of American competitiveness. Four, allow every small business to expense 100% of their investments in new technology and new equipment in 1 year, and you would suddenly make every American worker have access to the most modern technology in the world, and you would bring back to our shore the technology industries to serve the extraordinary market you just created. Five, abolish permanently the death tax, which is a position 80% of the American people agree with because they know instinctively it is wrong to say to people, if you work and save all your life, the government will take half of it when you die. And they know it is immoral to ask people to visit the undertaker and the IRS the same week. Those three changes would change everything. Lastly, who threatens us? And what do we need to do to be safe? I just want to make two sweeping points. First, our long-term strategic challenge is to fix America so we remain the most productive country in the world. If we do that, then China is not a problem. China is not a national security threat to us unless we are incompetent, because they can't possibly catch up with us if we reestablish a dynamic, entrepreneurial, hardworking, and honest country. But if we're determined to have schools that don't teach, laws, tax laws that kill jobs, regulations that stop progress, and litigation that avoids any new development, they will presently threaten us, but it won't be because of them. So that's the strategic challenge. The immediate challenge, and I'm going to be very politically incorrect. We had a shooting in Texas. We picked up a terrorist in Denver. We picked up terrorists in Detroit. We picked up terrorists in New York. They all had the same characteristic. They were not Rotarians. They didn't belong to the Kiwanis Club. They weren't members of the PGA. They all belonged to the radical wing of Islam, which is so politically incorrect, we're not even discussing it. And I want to assert unequivocally, debating Afghanistan is the wrong question. That is like debating Guadalcanal. The fact is, what we have to have is a debate about the national strategy on a worldwide basis of what threatens us and what are we going to do to win. And Afghanistan is a very small piece of a much bigger puzzle, part of which showed up at Fort Hood, part of which showed up in Detroit and in Denver and in New York, part of which is in Pakistan, India, South Thailand, Indonesia, Philippines, Iran, Iraq, part of which is captured by Guest of the Ayatollah, a book by Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down. Guest of the Ayatollah is about the hostage crisis of 1979-1980. The subtitle is Iran's First Shots in the War Against America. I would argue we've been engaged in a 30-year war, and that we just don't want to admit it because it's too frightening, and we don't want to talk about it because it's too threatening, and so we keep kidding ourselves. And one morning we won't be able to kid ourselves anymore. It's just a question of how bad it has to get before we start. I look forward very, very much to your questions.
Let me use this for Maria. Sure.
There you go. Thank you, Newt. That was outstanding. And to show our appreciation, we do have two gifts for you. One is a picture book of Naples that you'll get. And also donated by Tariq Ayerson is a picture book, Culture History of Marco Island.
Right.
So we hope you like those. And now we have scores and scores of questions, but Ula has done a good job of boiling them down to the essential few because we plan to adjourn at 1:30. So here's Ula.
So, first of all, just a little recap of what took place in the elections the other day, in New York State in particular. The question is, why would Republicans have run such a liberal candidate to begin with? Scosa Fava.
Oh, okay, that's right. I can stand over here because I've got a mic on.
Yep.
Okay, is this working all right? Okay. Yeah, look, Scosa Fava was a mistake. It's, you know, the 11 county chairs, under New York law, there are no primaries for specials, which is a mistake. But that's current law. The 11 county chairs went to four regional meetings. All the candidates performed in the four regional meetings. They then voted, and they unanimously picked her. She was clearly too liberal, and she clearly alienated Mike Long and the Conservative Party. That then blew up into a national cause celeb for the conservative movement. They managed to grind her down by the sheer weight of their attack combined with the Democrats' attack. So she finally first dropped out and then endorsed the Democrat. And then we managed inelegantly to have blundered so badly that we took a seat which has been Republican since the Civil War and gave it to the Democrats. Now, there's a lot of different lessons to be learned. One is Republicans shouldn't nominate somebody who starts a civil war in their own party. Another is conservatives are better be very careful about talking about third parties, because third parties will guarantee that Pelosi is speaker for life and that Obama is reelected. So there's a balance here. It doesn't mean you can't be a moderate and run, but she was very, I mean, she was not only pro-gay rights, she was also endorsed by Acorns. I mean, there were a lot of things she had done that sort of set her up as somebody who would enrage the conservative movement.
I think you just asked the second question, which was, what are the chances that the new third party of independent voters could emerge?
None.
I take it that you're...
It's an interesting hobby, but it's not as serious. if you want to govern, you have to influence one of the two major parties. There's not been, since 1856, a successful third party.
Term limits. Do we need a constitutional amendment to establish term limits for Congress?
I'm not opposed to term limits if they're 12 years, so the people who are there long enough. But if you look at the states that adopted six-year term limits, the only people who know what they're doing are the lobbyists and the bureaucrats. And what you actually did is took power away from the elected officials and embedded it, because by the time they get there and learn what they're doing, they leave. Florida is a good example. Your term limits are too short. And it's a very, very dangerous environment, because it puts too much power in the bureaucracy and the lobbyists. So what I actually think we've got to do is reestablish the congressional pattern of going home after 3 months. If you look at the, historically the idea was to have part-time members of Congress who actually represented people back home. We've invented full-time professional congressmen surrounded by full-time professional staffs, and they now have too much time on their hands. In the age of the word processor, you can write too much too fast. I gave up reading the absurd energy tax bill when I got to about page 270, where they were regulating jacuzzis. And I just decided a government so dumb that it's going to try to micromanage jacuzzis by law is, in fact, just makes no sense. But that's what happens when you hire lots of bright young people who have no experience, and you give them full-time jobs thinking they're powerful. They end up writing things down to the level of their understanding, so you get lots of trivia.
Here's a question on power of the unions. Power of the unions. Roughly 8% of the American population belongs to unions. 68% of Congress has been members of unions. What do you think of the power of the unions?
I don't think the last number is right. I'd be shocked if 68% of the members of Congress
have been.
Remember, Ronald Reagan belonged to a union. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that the great challenge is public employee unions, and the very simple solution is the unions should not be allowed to mandatorily collect dues and to mandatorily collect political contributions. In the states which require the union to ask the union members if they want to give money, they raised about 4% of the members say yes. In other states, 100% of the members give money because they have no choice. And if you simply said you cannot have compulsory donations, you can belong to the union, but the union cannot take money from you without your permission, you would overnight change the balance of power in state capitals.
A question on George Bush. Was George Bush good for the Republican Party?
No.
But
that's a very narrow way to judge him, but no.
I mean, no.
Clearly the 06 and 08 elections were what one would call success. On the other hand, I don't think it's fair to judge him by those two events. I think he's very much like Harry Truman. I think that the further we get away from him and the more we begin to realize how hard the problems were and how difficult the campaign was, again, in terms of what's happening with the radical Islam, I think that the more he will see as somebody who deserves respect.
Radical Islam, a direct question on Afghanistan. What is your position on our involvement in the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, I gave a speech in 2002 which made the State Department and the President very unhappy, in which I said, we have the wrong strategy, we have the wrong instruments, we are not capable today of doing what we need to do. I think you could give the same speech today. First of all, the number one key to Afghanistan is simple. We will never win there. The Afghans may. Mm-hmm. And we could help the modern Afghans defeat the radical Afghans. But we're not going to do it ourselves. Second, modernity is our friend, which means the more roads you build, the more wireless towers you put up, the more iPhones you give away, the better off you are. Because you break down isolation and you break down people who still live in the Middle Ages. And you give them a chance to see that there's this enormous world they can be part of that is fundamentally more prosperous, fundamentally better. This is a very deep cultural revolution. We should not underestimate this. I believe in the long run we have to win in Afghanistan. I believe we will be very shocked. If we accept failure in Afghanistan, we will be very shocked 10 years later at how expensive that failure becomes. We cannot have areas that people who are dedicated to our destruction can use as sanctuaries. And that's a huge challenge. And it's part of why President Bush came very close in his second inaugural to articulating the scale of our challenge and then backed off. But in fact, he was closer to right in his second inaugural than anybody has been in the last 10 years.
Thank you. While we're still in the global arena, two questions on global warming. What do you think of the emissions control and cap and trade proposals?
I think you have to understand. Cap and trade is a search for political power disguised in its environmental issue. I mean, if you want to understand the health debate and you want to understand the environmental debate, start with the following premise. The people who favor these bills want bigger government with more control over your life, with bureaucrats dictating how you live. And the excuses are health and the environment. But health, let me give you the example why. The former head of research at Microsoft, who's a very bright, very interesting guy, believes that there is a technique we could use that would offset any global warming for about $100 million a year by releasing in the very upper atmosphere the level of particulate matter that was released by Krakatoa when the volcano blew up in 1887. Because Krakatoa reduced the temperature of the planet by 2 degrees. She said, terrific, you got global warming, I'll give you global cooling. It costs about $100 million a year, you don't need a bureaucracy, don't worry about it. Well, nobody on the left will even look at it, because, my God, then you wouldn't need cap and trade. Then you wouldn't have power in Washington, then EPA couldn't regulate life. There is a provision in the health bill in the House to create a new office of health impact assessment, which would theoretically be able to look at every proposed new building in America by whether or not on top of your environmental assessment you would now have a health impact assessment, and now we could add a carbon assessment. And all of this is a design to kill the free market, take away your freedom, build huge bureaucracies which get to tell you what to do. So I've taken a position. I'm perfectly happy to say let's have less carbon in the atmosphere. Everybody who'd like less carbon in the atmosphere, let's pass a simple direct bill. You can build nuclear power plants. If we had the same amount of nuclear power plant production of electricity as France, we would put 2 billion tons a year less of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I just did that without having any central government control, so it's obviously a dumb idea because it doesn't achieve the real purpose. Goreism is the use of the environment for the purpose of creating a central bureaucracy. It is not about the environment.
The next question ties in somewhat. Business, the future business. Can America remain a great nation without a manufacturing base?
No.
Can a consumer society generate a great nation?
No.
No. You don't like to expand on that, but that's fine. That's all right. I think we all agree.
Sometimes just knows the correct answer. You know?
That's right. So here's you talked to this somewhat earlier, but a direct question on healthcare. What are your 3 best ideas to make healthcare more affordable?
Well, that actually we have 5 or 6 at the center. But if you want to go to healthtransformation.net, we founded the Center for Health Transformation to bring together people to actually develop a whole new generation of solutions. We have, for example, one of the largest hospital chains in the country is a member of the center. A number of pharmaceuticals are members of the center. We have all sorts of different groups. We work with governors. We just did an event in Nashville with Governor Bredesen. Number 1, you want to recenter the system on the individual. You can't take care of diabetes without the individual. You can't take care of asthma without the individual. You can't take care of cardiovascular disease without the individual. So you need to start with the individual. Two, you want to rethink the society and culture around them. What does that mean? Example, every state should adopt K through 12 5-day-a-week physical education. And you worry, quit worrying about juvenile diabetes and obesity. I'm not talking about type 1 juvenile diabetes, but quit worrying about, you know, teenagers being overweight and under-exercised. Change school lunch, school breakfast, and make them exercise. I'm a radical. I would reestablish walking to school. I know. In fact, I would go so far, because I'm a historian, I would reinvent raincoats and boots. Now, I know this is bold. I know I'm out at the edge. But we'd be a healthier country with kids who walk to school, even if they occasionally got wet.
Ask them how many of this in this audience walk to school.
How many of you ever walk to school? But I'm going back to 2 + 2 = 4. We keep trying to say, how can I find a breakthrough that allows my teenage kid to eat all sorts of stupid food while sitting on the couch doing nothing and still be healthy? The answer is you can't. Now, the third thing is you want a health delivery system. Notice, I didn't get to health delivery systems until I got through the individual and the culture and society. You want health delivery systems which take a combination of Deming's quality, the Toyota production system, and benchmark against best practices, and I believe you can take 40% out of the cost of health care. Now, only when you do these first three things do you get around to financing. But the idea that we're going to magically in Washington invent a financing plan without changing the health system and be able to afford it? I mean, these people are just living in cloud cuckoo land, but it doesn't have anything to do with health care. This is a fight of over control of your life, and you should let both of your senators understand how deeply you understand that this is not about health care. This is about their ability in Washington to run your life on their terms.
Excellent. One last question.
Okay.
The last question is, Mr. Speaker, will you be running for president?
Let me say, first of all, everything we're doing politically, we're doing at American Solutions, and you can see it at AmericanSolutions.com. At a very serious level, Calista and I will sit down in February of 2011, and we'll consult with a lot of friends. Joe Fogg would certainly be a good example. And if there's a large enough demand, we'll probably end up doing what we have to do as citizens. But I don't want to get involved in thinking about that. I don't want to change what I'm saying, think about the candidacy, get involved in all that baloney from now until February of 2011. But I want to close, if I could, by just reading one paragraph. This is, "And to try men's souls," which is an extraordinary moment, Christmas night, in the snow, huge snowstorm, crossing the Delaware at night in the ice, marching 9 miles. Washington, who understood, first great leader of modern democracy, understood, you have to marry the pen to the sword in a free society. People have to know why they're doing it. And so he had asked Thomas Paine to leave the army where he was a rifleman, to write a pamphlet. And that night, as men got aboard these boats, the officers read from the pamphlet which had just been published that week. And here's part of what they read. This is where the title comes from. "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. Britain, with an army to enforce her tyranny, has declared that she has a right not only to tax, but, quote, to bind us in all cases whatsoever. And if being bound in that manner is not slavery, then there is not such a thing as slavery upon earth. Even the expression is impious, for so unlimited a power can belong only to God. That's who we have been. But we'll decide in 10 and 12 is whether or not that's who we are." Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Just...
Thank you.
All right, two quick announcements. Nudy is going to be signing copies of that book provided by Borders out here. If you'd like to get a signed copy, he's going now. Second, our speaker next week is Governor Tim Pawlenty from Minnesota, and we will be meeting across the way. Leave your badges at the door on the way out. We stand adjourned. Thank you.